ಮೇಲೆ ಬರ್ತಿದ್ದೀರ ತಾನೇ ಇದ್ರ ನಮಸ್ತೆ ಸರಸ್ವರಿ ದೇವಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ನಂದು for bringing this chair down to the right level. I would have been very embarrassed. Although I'm a little higher, but at least I'm not sitting higher than Prabhupada, so this is proper. It's actually a very beautiful vista of these windows, and it's a great honor to be here today on this New Year's Day. 1999 to help in the pre-dedication ceremony to assist the devotees who worked very hard to get it to this stage. Certainly Srila Prabhupada is very proud of all of you who are committed to this project. It increasingly will become the focal point for all of this country, not just for those who are actively seeking spiritual life, but for everybody. Just like Naimisharanya is the great center of the universe, so it is described in the Shastras. So this circular temple will become the hub of New Zealand. I want to also thank the devotees who have been here for a long time and dedicated their lives to this project. And I got her permission to do this a little earlier, so I'm going to ask Mandri Devi Dasi to read a little poem that she wrote for the occasion of the dedication or pre-dedication of this temple, which is a very wonderful poem which anticipates the grand opening of this temple on Janmashtami and is a kind of prayer to the Lord to help us, to guide us to this very appropriate conclusion to all the hard work that's gone on here. So, Madhu, if you would please stand and read your poem. Maybe you can stand next to Srila Prabhupada here, who I'm sure will want to hear very close up what you say.
It's a very short poem, don't worry. It's a sort of a sonnet. I was inspired because I've been talking with Maharaj about poetry and Shakespeare and wonderful quotations which apply to Krishna consciousness. So this is called Krishna's New Home. Here we are standing in our temple bare, not yet an altar, no sweet lords to see. Our souls are aching in anxiety. We want to serve our Krishna. We would bear all burdens to complete this Mandir affair. So many friends, devotees all, will be remembered for their generosity and their commitment. Hear our fervent prayer. 10 years of building, structure made to stand 10,000 years, and now the time is at hand. On Krishna's birthday in the year 2000, we'll have a party here, as never seen. Dancing and feasting, joyful kirtan sounding, up to the heavens, demigods rejoicing. Bhakti Bhavan, our temple of devotion, will open wide her doors and welcome all. We'll see the altar, marbled, gilded, full with flowers and garlands, silken cloth and jewels. Oh, now who will our radiant lords behold, at last as Radhagiri Dhari take their place? It comes to pass when we so much desire, for Krishna will provide by his kind grace.
Very appropriate and very visionary. course, Srila Prabhupada was a great visionary, and we're living in the wake of his sojourn in this material world. And he had the vision that temples like this would arise in many parts of the world, and they would become great oases for the parched, burning hearts of the conditioned souls who are in this wheel of samsara, in this blazing forest fire of material enjoyment, so that they could gain the cooling waters of relief in places like this. So, when I say that it is to become the center of New Zealand, this is actually not just an idle talk or a supposition or a speculation, but this is actually the prediction of Srila Prabhupada. There were many forecasts in the Puranas, like the Brahma Vairata Purana, in the Bhavishya Purana, and many others, signifying that there would be a great golden age. It would be the rising moon, Krishna Chaitanya Chandradoya, of Lord Chaitanya. And inevitably it would rise just like the moon. After its waxing period, it begins to after its waning period, it begins to wax, and it grows until it becomes the full moon. So, just as sure as death, we were quoting some poets, Prabhupada quoted that one, the moon will gain its full-blown form, and the visions of Srila Prabhupada, one by one, because they are part of Shastra, because Prabhupada is part of Shastra, these great smritis, certainly will come to pass. Bhakta Joshua asked me about my meeting with Srila Prabhupada, and that became the topic of today's speech, somehow or other. So I'm going to try to reiterate my first meetings with Srila Prabhupada. I guess since we were watching the Abhay Charan video and we're all interested in the history of Srila Prabhupada, his life, it's also somewhat interesting to hear about some of our early meetings with him. And as we pointed out, one morning class I read the paper written by Dr. Thomas Hopkins about the history of ISKCON, how ISKCON would have to study its own history, and how the perceptions of some of Prabhupada's disciples would become something like the Gospels and the Christian confessions. It would become part of the historical record, at least. So I don't think this is going to be completely accurate, but I will try to convey what my impressions were. One thing that struck me, and everybody who came to see Prabhupada, or even hear about him, and those of you who weren't able to meet him, you've seen him in videotapes, you've heard his voice in many audio tapes. And I think we've all understood that Prabhupada was not presenting anything new, and what attracted us most, probably most of us, to him, was the fact that he wasn't inventing anything. He wasn't one among the number of thousands of spiritual so-called charlatans who delude the public for personal reasons, for personal gain. But he was really a transparent medium for the Lord Krishna, for Vedic knowledge. So in one sense, this Bhagavad Gita, as it is nothing new either. It's just presented exactly as Krishna presented it, but with more than just a little bit of Prabhupada added. But the presentation was exactly as has come down, unchanged through the years. Since we're talking about poetry in English language, I'm going to divert your attention for just a minute, less than a minute, to read something. It was written probably in the early part of the century about how people in their respective languages repeat the wisdom of what has gone before. To give just a hint of what Srila Prabhupada and the great sages have brought forth unchanged. This is unauthored, it's anonymous. The preface to a book of quotations says, a successful writer or speaker wisely and freely falls back on the good things that have been written or said by others. Users of these quotations are as wise as if they had originated them, for they could never originate even one-tenth of the material that they can borrow. If that's true in the material sense, how much more true it is in the spiritual sense. Those who are transparent via media, for the knowledge that has come down to us through yugas and kalpas and lifetimes of Brahma, one more can be said of those great saints and sages and rishis and munis who have, acharyas who have brought us knowledge from the Vedas. So Prabhupada had that aura of authenticity, we might say. He had an aura of great affection. And I think that this is probably what attracted all of us. It certainly was what one of the qualities that attracted me. So I'll try to recount the origin of my meeting with him. And try to switch to a little bit more informal way of speaking. I was living in New York at the time. I guess you need to know a little about me to get the context right. The word loft may have come from the fact that Prabhupada was living in a loft when I first met him, what we called lofts. And I was also living in a loft. In the 1960s, and probably still it's true, the city of New York granted what they called artist-in-residence facilities to certain people that wanted to live in lofts as artists. And they had a little sign they put on the front door called, it would say AIR, means artist in residence. And they would give special concessions for rent and for utilities and for the fact that it was just more or less a bare room that you could furnish in the way you wanted. So I was a musician at the time, that was my livelihood. And I wanted a place where I could have musicians rehearse and not bother the neighbors. So I got a loft in the Bowery. And there were no other people living around there. They were just businesses. So nobody really minded if music was going all night or all day and very loud. So there was another artist in residence, loft, on the same block. Belonged to a gentleman named Harvey Combe, who was an artist, a painter. Didn't matter whether you were a performing artist or a fine artist or whatever. The artist was an artist or a dancer. Who qualifies and get this AIR status. So, Harvey was a fine painter, and he had met Srila Prabhupada maybe in 1965, towards the end of 1965, beginning of 1966, and they had some meetings at the place where a Dr. Mishra from India had been lecturing. And at some point, Harvey told Srila Prabhupada that he was going to go move to the West Coast from New York. He was going to move to California, and that he would let Prabhupada have the use of his loft. There was another gentleman living in that loft at the time, he told Prabhupada. But Prabhupada didn't care. His name was Paul. I think he's written as David in the Lilamrita book. For legal reasons, they didn't use his real name. He was 18 years old, and Harvey told Prabhupada that he would have to share this loft with this young man. But Prabhupada seemed not to mind, and he moved to that place. So that was in about June of 1966, and I was on a bus going across, they called them crosstown buses, going from the east of Manhattan to the west of Manhattan. I guess I was going from west to east. And I met a colleague of mine who told me about a Swami who was living in the Bowery and who was lecturing. So I this was a very, very short conversation because he was only on the bus with me for about 5 minutes. And in that course of that conversation, I remember saying to him that I think I'll go and check it out because I think I need that right now. I was a spiritual seeker. I was reading Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist books. I was reading Christian Mohammedan and I was reading books of Taoism and Confucianism, and I had a whole library of books, and I was a very fond aficionado, I thought I was, of Indian classical music, and I was kind of ripe for the picking, you might say. So he gave me the address, and I realized it was just in the same block where I had my place. Bowery was originally it was a bowery. The English word bowery meant, I think, something like a flower garland or bouquet or something people wore, a bowery, or a place, it was very beautifully decorated with flowers. And then it became Bowery, B-O-W-E-R-Y instead of I-E, and it became known as a place where a lot of bars were located. And it became the place where all the derelicts assembled, the drunkards, old drunkards, who would be carried away sometimes, dead from drinking on the street. And it smelled, especially in the summer, when the summer heat was upon the city, very oppressively, and it was a very moist heat. The atmosphere smelled like a mixture of beer and urine. I'm not exaggerating. That's what it was like to walk in the Bowery. And sometimes you'd have to walk past drunks who were just laying there unconscious and drinking. That's where Prabhupada took up his residence. So one evening, following the piece of paper that my friend had given me, or I'd written down the address, 105 Bowery, I went to see Srila Prabhupada hear him lecture. So there were a couple of raucous-type characters sitting out on the stoop, the step right in front of the doorway. And they were carrying on, saying something I couldn't really understand, but didn't want to let me in the door. I sort of like, get out of here. So I had to sort of storm my way through. They were really kind of harmless, because they were so drunk. And then I got inside, and it was all dark. There was still light outside, but there were no lights in the passageway. So there was a big stairway. And the stairway, instead of going up one direction and then back the opposite direction, 180 degrees, it just went straight ahead up four flights. So I went up the four flights. There was a glass transom above the doorway. So there's a little light on the first level, and then it got darker and darker, so I had to sort of feel my way up the stairway. And as I got towards the top, I heard the cartels clanging, ting, 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 and then I knew there was a prayer meeting going on up there. So I got up to the very top, and there was a little light shining through the chink of the doorway, and that was it. That was the place. I knew it was the place. So I opened the door, walked in, and it was a very big loft, about maybe 30 meters long and 15 or 20 wide. And are you metricated here, or should I say it? Yeah, yards. It's about the same number of yards. So it was pretty dark, and at the far end, at the opposite end of the room, the area nearest the street, there I saw Prabhupada for the first time. He was sitting on a platform that was about 18 inches high, and a big platform, maybe 2 by 3 or 4 meters. And he seemed very radiant. There was just a bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling, on of course. So the atmosphere was very austere, very impoverished looking to me. I mean, it wasn't like a fixed up loft, like I had decorated my place. This looked like pretty bare. So I walked forward, and Prabhupada was chanting. There was a small group of people sitting on a carpet in front of the dais. Thing he was sitting on. And maybe five or six people, when they were chanting, Prabhupada would chant and they were chanting Hare Krishna in response, lead and response fashion. So I was very struck with his kind of erect posture and scholarly look. He wore red glasses, the kind that you have in the temple on big Prabhupada, almost exactly like that. And a pullover skivvy that was flesh-colored, sweat made of cotton, wool, cotton, very thick. And he had a little drum, a little African-style drum, about this big, kind of like a, shaped like a cylinder that comes out like this. I don't know what you call it, but... And then he was playing it sort of like this. And a few people were clapping and had some... I think they had some kartals, but I'm not really sure about that. So I sat down, everyone's on the floor, and I tried to get the words, try to chant along. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I wasn't quite sure what the words were. I think I was maybe saying Krishna instead of Krishna. I knew about Krishna, but I wasn't sure what chanting was. Prabhupada's accent was unusual. I mean, his way of saying Krishna, I never heard anyone say it like that. So that chant went on for some time, and then it ended. And then Prabhupada began to speak. And this apparently was recorded. There was a tape recorder in that loft. It was made by Robert's tape recorder company. It was a big reel-to-reel tape recorder. They didn't have cassettes much in those days. And the tapes were spinning. And apparently this lecture is recorded and available now on CDs that are issued by the archives. Aniruddha of Melbourne has a copy of it. And so Prabhupada spoke in a very, you'll hear this CD at some point, but as I recall, he spoke in very plaintive, kind of urgent tones, in a very high-pitched voice, kind of urging the audience to listen. There was a great sense of urgency then in his voice. I've heard some of the tapes since then, and that sense of urgency is not quite as strong. I mean, it's there, but it wasn't as high-pitched, wasn't as plaintive, as so much as making an appeal as it was in those early days. And then throughout the talk, which was hard to understand for me, because his accent was much deeper than, much greater, thicker, as they say, when he first came, and he didn't have much association talking with American people and not much practice in speaking to them. So it's very hard at first, especially, to distinguish what he was actually saying. It took a while to get accustomed to his way of speaking. I still have trouble understanding what some of you people say. That's my own problem. But anyway, it was hard. But then I got used to it and I started to understand what he said. And then I realized that he was sometimes speaking in a completely different language. He was speaking in Sanskrit. Sometimes. So I was able to distinguish between the Sanskrit and the English finally. But I realized that his speech was laced very profusely with Sanskrit. And he was quoting all these verses, all these Sanskrit things, and I had no idea what they meant. But it had the ring of authority. And I was very attracted to that because I thought, this is really a genuine person. And in the course of my search, I'd encountered many charlatans, several anyway, who I was just very disappointed in. So I thought this was one thing that, due to the Sanskrit maybe, or the aura, or the tones in which he was speaking, the whole atmosphere was one of great authenticity. Something was coming forward from an ancient past that was not being changed. So there was a sense of Prabhupada really being a great person. Of course, he was elevated, and we were sitting on the floor, and there were a group of people. So that all from the beginning made you feel very kind of humble, and Prabhupada was not ordinary, that he was a very great and transcendental personality right from the start. But there was something else. There were other factors that made me feel that way. But I just kind of got a little impression of what he was saying. I wasn't really assimilating philosophically much. I was just getting a little bit, because I was trying to take it all in, you know, visually, what was going on. They say that people who are less intelligent learn things by visual rather than by oral. So I was kind of in that mode, you know, just picking up on what the people were doing, what Prabhupada looked like, what the atmosphere was like. And that was one thing that was very impressive, that the atmosphere was one of great simplicity and poverty. And it added to the authenticity of Srila Prabhupada, that he didn't care. He wasn't one of these uptown, so-called uptown swamis. I'd been up there and sat in the leather chairs with the audience and wondered what it was, why I was even there sometimes. Couldn't see any sort of real life, anything really positive coming from those uptown fellows. So I didn't really kind of know what he was talking about, really. I just got a few impressions. Like he would say, "I am not this body," but he would say it in such a with such conviction and in such a plaintive tone that it just kind of stuck in my mind. "I am not this body," he would say over and over again. I just recall him saying that. And it was a very mysterious thing to hear, because it just never was spoken before, really. And I never really thought about it much. And so I didn't think about it as applying to myself, but I thought, because of conviction, that, well, he is not his body. Anyway. I had to believe that I couldn't think of it in relation to myself. Somehow, I got this idea that Prabhupada was extraterrestrial. He wasn't an ordinary human person. That was coming from that speech. But other than that, I didn't really know what he was talking about much. So after he finished, I had been... Well, before even he had finished, while he was speaking, and over the weeks prior to my seeing him, I was rolling a lot of thoughts around in my mind. Very mysterious kind of Zen-type Buddhistic thought and Taoist things that try to reconcile contradictions in life. So when it came time for the questions, when he said, "Do you have any questions?" I immediately sort of burst out with something that I was rolling around in my mind, because I wasn't really listening properly. And I asked something to the effect that, what if you were walking along the road and you saw a young man beating on an old man? What would you do? Would you stop and interfere, or would you walk on? That was one of the mysterious Eastern, I thought, things that should be asked to a wise man. Anyway, that's also recorded on the CD. You'll hear what I really said and what Prabhupada answered me. But the way I recall it, it was part of the lecture, and Aniruddha mentioned that he heard that question I asked. So Prabhupada gave a very long answer, as I recall. And he talked about being on a spiritual platform. And I think that the essence of that answer was that unless you're on a spiritual platform, you won't know what to do. You just won't know. Unless you're spiritually fixed. So I thought, in my strange way of thinking, that Prabhupada was either avoiding the question or, you know, was somehow withholding the answer from someone who should know better, or whatever. Because he didn't directly answer. And then I asked again a similar question. I said something to the effect that, "You're not answering my question." So at some point I think it went back and forth a few times, and finally he said, "Well, you should interfere." I think it was because he thought that that's what I was thinking one should do. I don't know. Anyway, we'll hear it. I'm very eager to hear this tape myself, this CD, to hear what Prabhupada actually said. So it's very impudent and challenging, and certainly not appreciating Srila Prabhupada's presence. But then others asked questions, and there was some discussion. And then I thought that I should speak to him afterwards, because this would be a great opportunity, because I had the impression that Prabhupada was a very great person, even though he was in very impoverished circumstances. But I thought, this is an opportunity, because no one could really stop me. And in other words, I'd have the opportunity to speak to someone who was very exalted. And he didn't seem to, you know, have any place to go. So I could sort of, you know, ask and not, you know, privately, personally, questions without being sort of rushed away, or he wouldn't be rushing away. So I, after the lecture was over and things became more informal, I walked up to him to speak with him. And he just sat. So I was standing and he was sitting, and so it was that I was looking down. He was looking up. And he had a very innocent look. It reminded me of my grandfather because it was very acceptant and very happy. He had a very happy countenance. So I didn't know what to say. I was going to get into a bit of a philosophical discussion, but his look was so disarming that I really sort of forgot what I was going to say. I didn't really know what to say. So all I could think of was, well, I'm just down the road here, and I'll come back. So I had these Indian instruments in my loft, my studio. So the first thing I said to Prabhupada was, I have a tambura. Of course you have a tambura. What's it doing over there? And at that point, I just really couldn't think of anything else to say. And he just said, okay. And then he said that he was lecturing 3 nights a week and what they were. And he said, I'd bring it the next time. So what actually seemed to happen there was that I felt I was being admitted into a very special, very kind of elite, you might say, or society that the Prabhupada belonged to, that I was being admitted into his presence, that I could come with my instrument, that I could sit there and just play with the band. And, you know, my way of thinking, that was all there was necessary, that was being admitted into the best band in the world, the Hare Krishna band, or the band of the master, or whatever, that I would be able to accompany him. Because that's what tambura is for, they're for accompaniment, as you know what tamburas do. So I just thought that was it. I didn't have anything else to say. My wishes were fulfilled. I was admitted into the private company of the great master, and I would come back. And I thought that was enough for one meeting. And that was the end of my first meeting. So that was it. That was my first meeting with Prabhupada. Maybe somebody'd like to ask some questions, because our time is limited. Yes.
You did get in the first instance, except he was exalted and so austere. In the first look, you know, did you get the change?
Yeah.
You came to the conclusion that he was exalted and austere?
Yeah. So you're asking, how could you be both at the same time?
Yeah.
Well, by exalted, to me, it didn't necessarily mean opulent or surrounded by nice furniture or well-dressed. By exalted, I meant distinguished, or someone who was great, not in the material sense, but of a stature, of an unusually high stature among human beings, a special person. I considered religious people exalted people if they were very high people, if they had lofty thoughts, high thoughts of God and goodness. And that's why I thought of Prabhupada, that he was of a very high character, morally, spiritually, in terms of goodness, in terms of being pure and authentic, of being wise, of being knowledgeable, of being intelligent. That's what he came off. I had kind of images in my mind of what a holy person should be like. That he should speak very deep philosophy. He should speak inscrutable things sometimes, which you can't understand. So in that way, I thought Prabhupada fulfilled all my kind of stereotypes of what a holy person should be. What a great, a truly great, not just great in the material sense person, but a spiritual person, you might say, should be. And part of that perception was the fact that the surroundings were very austere. Most of the so-called holy men that I'd seen, or religious people, were in a big church, or a big synagogue, or a big temple, where there was just all sorts of rich people, rich things, beautiful tapestries and surroundings in big buildings, and they had big cars. So this was just the opposite. This was the Bowery. And there were cobwebs on the ceiling, and it was like, you know, undone, like the ceiling. It wasn't, but it was never decorated. There was never a proper ceiling board, but it was just raw beams. It was very dark. And all of Prabhupada's, I didn't know at the time, but his washing all hung on behind a barrier on a wall. So that was, I mean, then just to be in the Bowery was considered poverty personified almost. So So in that way, I thought, here is a great person, and exalted, and poverty was part of that exaltation.
Yes. Maharaj, what was it like for you when you started to understand the philosophy, and at what point did the relationship start to change or develop between you and Sri Prabhupada?
One devotee who was a friend of mine before he became a devotee was there. Also had a loft, not far away, but not in the Bowery. His was a little bit more fixed up than mine was. He told me that Swamiji had some books and that I could purchase these books. This is like the second or maybe third meeting. So I said, yeah, you can buy them. So I thought, oh, great, fantastic, books. Because I was a very avid reader of those kinds of things, especially. And I forgot to bring money, though. I just thought, oh, I have 5 books. So I approached Prabhupada and I said, I understand that you have some books. These were his Bhagavatams he brought over in some cases. And he said, oh, yes. And I said, I'd like to buy them. He said, yes. And he had them right where he was sitting. He just reached down and pulled up these 3 Bhagavatams. And he handed them to me. And I said, oh, how much are they? And he said, they're $5 each. And I didn't have any money. I just had a $5 bill in my pocket. And I said, I'm very sorry. I didn't bring money, but I have $5. And he said, well, you can give me that now and pay the rest next time you come. So Prabhupada was the original set distributor. So I began to read the Bhagavatam. And I got like great revelations from those books. In fact, I remember walking across the street reading the Bhagavatam. I actually tried to avoid going out of the house because I wanted to just sit there and read. But when I had to go, I would take the Bhagavatam with me. And whether I was on the bus or walking, I never stopped reading it. I just kept reading and reading and reading until it was finished. And the reason I kept reading it was because I thought that it somehow or other I had stumbled onto the absolute truth when I was reading the Bhagavatam. Especially the descriptions. Of course, I was 24 years old then. Experience with the material world was that it was a world of suffering and pain. And when I was reading the descriptions of the Kali Yuga in the first canto, I'm just trying to think of the particular passage. Oh, that people were misguided, unfortunate, and unlucky. That somehow or other struck me as being very, very wise and very unusual. I'd never seen it really written anywhere. And then because I was actually had read Bhagavad Gita and other books, but never read, there were no purports to them, and so I didn't really understand what they meant. It was very difficult going. I appreciate them, but I actually didn't understand how the effect would, you know, how I could apply it in my own situation. So by reading the Bhagavatam, I became convinced that this was actually absolute. It was truth, absolute truth. And then I began to really understand what Prabhupada was saying. I began to listen more carefully to what he said in his lectures. And I think it was through those Bhagavatams that I became actually convinced that this is the philosophy, not just to read, but to embrace. And the countenance of Prabhupada took on a completely new dimension at that point. When I began to hear him speak, I was hearing what I was reading. So that happened, I think, a few days after I actually met him. I started to read. Got greatly enlightened.
Okay. Would you ever tell the story of when Prabhupada came to your flat?
The story of when Prabhupada came to my flat? He was I had been asleep for about 1 hour, as was my habit. It was a weekend night, and I would sometimes work on the weekends, and I didn't get back till 4 or 5 in the morning. Prabhupada was up walking around, so the telephone rang, and it was Carl, who came, Carlapati. And he said, Swamiji and I were out for a walk, and we thought we'd come and visit you. And I said, are you crazy? It's 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, Swamiji really wanted to come up and see you. So I couldn't say no. And I said, well, where are you? We're in a phone booth, just near your front door. So I very quickly got up and dressed and went over to the door. And he and Prabhupada came in. I'll just abbreviate this. It's got a long story, but there was a television set that had been going all night, and I mean, I don't even remember when it was turned on. It was probably just going for days, and it was Saturday morning after Friday night, and all the children's cartoons were playing. So after we sat and were talking for a while, Prabhupada, I guess he noticed it in the beginning, but he looked at it and said, "This is nonsense." And then I for the first time realized what it was and that it was on and there were cartoons, and I said, "Oh yeah, this is nonsense." I went over and stood up and walked over and turned it off. Anyway, to shorten the length of the story, Prabhupada said that Paul, who he was living with, had become deranged. And there was some intimation that he was taking hallucinogens at the time. Is that what they call them? Hallucinogens? Anyway, LSD.
Hallucinogenic.
But I kind of thought the guy was a bit nuts anyway, so I didn't think it was like a big deal. I said, what's he doing? So Prabhupada said, well, he's complaining when he goes into the... Oh, he's not putting his soap away in the shower. And it's slippery. And I look at Carl and I say, what's the problem here? And then Prabhupada started to say, well, he was ill-naming me. And then I thought, oh, this is pretty serious. You know, he's calling an exalted person by bad names. It's very bad. And then Prabhupada looked at me. Hey, Prabhupada, I think... As I remember, he was sitting next to me, and Carl was at the other end. He said, "He's a very dangerous man." Yes, dangerous man. What's he living with, a dangerous man? Are you going to kill him or what? And then Prabhupada said that in India we have a saying that one finds oneself a guru. One sits down opposite the guru and hears the guru's message. And then when he's learned that message, he kills the guru, moves his dead body aside, and he sits in his place, and he becomes the guru. So I was thinking, wow, my God, what's going on here? He's trying to kill Prabhupada. I mean, it was just so heavy, I didn't know what to say. So then Carl said, well, I think that we have to get Swamiji another place to live. So, yeah, okay, I kind of got the idea that he wanted to move in with me. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure that was what the drift of it was, but this other Paul was a bit of a strange character, and it seemed like Prabhupada didn't really care too much, and I was a little, you know, not so mad as that guy. Anyway, while that thought was kind of spinning around in my mind, and I had my music and my musicians coming over, I thought, this place just wouldn't work, you know. Besides, I was very attached to my... what it was, what I was doing. Carl said that I can offer Swamiji some temporary space in my loft, and so that was the kind of what was going to happen. That was the direction it was going to take. So we all kind of agreed on that. We sat and talked some more, and then I think it was either that day or the next day, Prabhupada moved over to Carl's house for a few days, and then he moved up to Dr. Mishra's place. And then within, I think, 10 days down to 2nd Avenue. So that was Prabhupada coming from my flat. So I think that's it. That's our time's up. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.